This is Greyhound Nation, Episode 10, recorded Sunday, November 1st, 2020. Interview with author Kieran O'Brien. Greyhound Nation is a podcast for Greyhound enthusiasts produced by Greyhound enthusiasts. To learn more about our show and its hosts, visit our website at greyhoundnation.dog. That's greyhoundnation.dog. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Greyhound Nation podcast. I'm Michael Burns. Now, here's your host, John Parker.
Welcome back, Greyhound lovers. We've sure enjoyed your responses to the podcast. I hope you'll continue to enjoy it. And if you get a chance, go on one of the podcast sites and leave us a review when you get a chance. We always enjoy reading those. So we've got an author. This is one of our first authors we've had, in addition to Charlie Blanning. But this author is one of fiction. Now, I've been reading for a number of years the Dick Francis novels are surrounded in England in steeplechasing. And I've always thought, why can't Greyhound Racing have a Dick Francis that writes mysteries, crime thrillers, etc., about greyhound racing? It certainly got all the potential that horse racing does. Well, a few months ago, while we were introducing the new podcast, I got a Facebook message from today's guest, Kieran O'Brien. And Kieran said, hey, check out this book, Edge Your Bets. And it's on Amazon. And sure enough, I bought the Kindle version and absolutely loved it. It truly is in the Dick Francis genre. So I thought everybody might enjoy hearing from a crime thriller author who writes about greyhound racing. So, Kieran, welcome.
Thank you, John. Well, glad to be here.
So let's begin at the beginning and tell us a little bit about your background in greyhounds and greyhound racing.
Well, my background in greyhound racing started in the mid 70s. I'm 52, so I was born in the late 60s, and I was brought up in Bristol. Bristol had a greyhound track, and my dad worked in the betting industry. My brother was a keen bettor of horses and dogs. I was taking greyhound racing, I think it was the first time when I was 8, and I went to Bristol Dogs, and fell in love with it there and then. It's been a passion of mine for nigh on 45 years now. My first ever job as a schoolboy was in greyhound racing. I was working in the bars at the dog track, you know, going around collecting the glasses, cleaning them up and taking them back in. I was about 14. And so that's where, you know, I followed my passion, and that's where it all started for me back in the mid 70s. I've been a lover of greyhound racing ever since.
Oh, you really do go way back. And it sounds like you just barely missed Charlie Blanning. He's a little older than you, and he lived in Bristol, and his father and grandfather raced greyhounds on the Bristol area track. So it sounds like you have a background similar to his in terms of going to the track from a young age. So what was your next job then after you worked in the bar?
Well, believe it or not, I was still at school when I was 17. And unfortunately, my parents, my mother's brother died, and when he died, he lived in Ireland, and he didn't leave a will. So there was a massive infighting over who's going to get the house, et cetera, et cetera. And my parents decided to up sticks and leave Bristol and go to Ireland. And unfortunately, I was doing my secondary education at the time, and I had to go with them. So I ended up moving from Bristol to the west coast of Ireland. And when I say it was very bleak and very few people there, it was a village of about 300 people where everybody was related to everybody and everybody knew everybody. And I was this, you know, this 17-year-old boy taken away from all his friends and school colleagues. And it's actually where the bulk of this book, which I've written, is actually based. I've brought in all my experiences as a child of A, knowing about Bristol Dogs, but using the background of this small little village in the west coast of Ireland to, you know, bring it into the book. So, you know, you can, I can visualize, people who read, who will read the book will visualize, I think I've described it in such a way that you can actually visualize, you know, the area the book is actually based in. But they'll, it'll send them off to Google just to look up the pictures, just to see if what I'm saying is true.
Yeah, I'm beginning, as you were describing, upping sticks and moving to a small village in Ireland, I was already beginning to say, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, and that was, believe it or not, that was, from that moment onwards, it's around about 17, I was like 17, 18. I was stuck, really, because in Ireland, I finished my first lot of secondary education, because in England, your secondary education finishes at 16. If you then want to go on to higher education, you do it for 2 years between 16 and 18. Whereas in Ireland, the secondary education doesn't finish until you're 18. So we thought, well, I'm 17, we'll go off to the local secondary school, Christian Brothers school, whichever school was available. And they wouldn't accept me because they said I'd already done my secondary education. Because I don't know how it is in America, but in England, your secondary education starts at 11. And finishes at 16. In Ireland, it starts at 13 and finishes at 18. So you've still got that five-year gap. So I wasn't accepted at any school. So I couldn't work because I was not old enough. And I couldn't go to school in Ireland because the school said that my education had been completed and I'd have an unfair advantage when it came to doing their finishing exams. So I was a little bit in limbo.
And so what was the Greyhound contact in Ireland?
The Greyhound contact in Ireland was none, apart from the fact that I stayed in touch with a few friends from Bristol Dogs. And I promised myself that if I ever moved back to the UK, the first thing I was going to do when I moved back to the UK was to buy a Greyhound. Now, I went the convoluted way around it. When I lived in Ireland for 3 years, I learned every aspect a farming John known to man. So that goes from shearing sheep, delivering lambs, milking cows, climbing mountains with sheep dogs, how to dig trenches. I learned the hard way in that, you know, it was quite hard labor working for your parents on a small holding in the west coast of Ireland, where it was just, the weather was, I'd say out of 365 days of the year, it probably rained for about 300 of them. And that's if you were lucky. There's a saying, there's a big range of mountains in the Killary Harbour, the Killary Fjord. They're called the Mulray Mountains. And if the top of those mountains are covered in clouds, you've normally got about an hour before it started raining. And, you know, the farmers would actually use that as a guide, you know, if they were bringing in the hay or if there was anything, the mother's bringing in the washing or whatever. You'd look to the mountains, and that was your weather guide. You didn't have the internet in those days, obviously, and you didn't listen to the radio, but it was just nature. You'd look out across the mountains. The tops were covered in either snow or covered in mist. The rains were coming. So you'd do that. So for 3 years, I did that. And then in, I think it was 1988, I'd been 21, just come up to, just before my 21st birthday, I moved to the Isle of Man. Now, the Isle of Man is a small little island, as we know, between Ireland and the UK. And I lived in the Isle of Man for 8 years and had no input in ground racing whatsoever. None.
That must have been tough.
It was hard work. Yeah,
all those years.
It was hard work. It was an education, you know, in that, you know, I went into the finance sector. So I started earning a little bit of money and, you know, progressed as everybody does if they work hard and they put their head down. And greyhound racing, I missed that. Unfortunately, because I'm living in the Isle of Man when I did, I missed out on probably the best era of greyhound racing in the UK, which is unfortunate for me. I look back on the videos, but I, you know, the Skirlo champs and the Ballyregan Bobs.
Yeah, yeah.
The best era of greyhound racing in England. And I wasn't there. You know, I was in the Isle of Man, and the only thing you ever saw racing were rabbits on golf courses. You know, you didn't see dogs, and you didn't see horses. So that was the case until 1995, and I got promoted from my job in the Isle of Man internally, moved to Reading in England, which is not far, about 40 miles from London. And I made a promise to myself that I would buy a dog. And I was back in the UK about 4 months, went down to Bristol Dogs, and I bought a dog. And I've been an owner ever since.
Tell us about that first greyhound.
That first greyhound was a dog called Pole Rating. He was a big black dog. I went to the trainer and I said, I knew the trainer from my time, obviously, from working at Bristol all those years previously. So he said to me, he saw me when I came back. He recognized me as soon as I came back. He said, I know you. I said, yes, you do. Yeah, we haven't seen each other for a while, but 10 years, but you recognize me. I said, I want to buy a dog. So I bought a dog off him within the kennel. It was a dog that he owned himself. And it had its problems. It was a dog that was plagued with injury. So I thought to myself, you know, I've been sold a dud here. But he said, but after the first 2 months when the dog hadn't won a race, he said to me, he said, look, the dog's not won a race. I'm not going to charge you any kennel fee. He said, because I think you're in this for the long haul. And the day he told me he wasn't going to charge me a kennel fee, the following day the dog won. And the feeling of having a dog win for you for the first time, it's very, very difficult to describe the euphoria of what it's like when you're the first greyhound you own wins. And as it happens, it was a trophy race as well. So it was a race where you got to go out onto the podium and you patted the dog on its head and you got the trophy. Yeah. And from that moment onwards, I've been a greyhound owner ever since.
Now, have you always owned just one dog at a time or more than one?
I only ever once had more than one at one time because I don't like to divide them. I like to put everything into that one particular dog. Now, I've been fortunate in that the majority of the dogs I have had over the years I've never spent much money on them. Never, ever spent much money on them. I look for dogs that are, shall we say, already racing. So, you know, I can watch their potential for 2 or 3 weeks, maybe a month to 6 weeks, and find out if the dog is for sale. And then if the dog is for sale, I buy it. But I normally buy a dog from a track that I don't think is suited. So, for example, you may have an early pace dog, a dog that flies out of the traps and doesn't stay, you know, he doesn't get the full distance that the track it's running at. And I would look for those dogs to move it to a track which is better suited to its style of running. And I've had so much success with that in the dogs that I've bought that, you know, I've very rarely had a kennel bill. I've been very, very lucky. And in 2003, myself and my brother, who, you know, I mentioned earlier, is a fantastic, he's a massive follower of greyhound racing himself. He'd moved to America. He was based out in America. He was working out in Baltimore. And I said to him, I said, should we buy a dog? He said, yes, but if we buy this dog, I want you to try and find the dog that is capable of being a hurdler. I want a dog that will jump hurdles. Because he said, we're big horse racing fans, but we're big horse racing fans of jump racing, not flat racing.
Yeah.
And I went out and I knew what I was looking for. I was looking for an early pace dog that was ran on the outside of the track. So he was a wide runner and he had early pace. Unfortunately, I found one. There was a trainer called Nick Carter at Crayford. Found the dog for me. He schooled it for me, did a brilliant job in schooling the dog. And we ended up, within a year, we had a champion.
We had a dog
that won, it won everything. It won the English champion hurdle, which was, that for me, was the best night I thought at that time of my life. It was, you know, I always wanted to have a dog that was good enough to run on television. On the live Sky meetings, and he was the first dog I had to do that, and he won, so that was brilliant. He won the champion hurdle, and when he won the champion hurdle, in England, there's a much of an English-Irish rivalry, as you're probably aware. We had the English Derby final yesterday, which was again won by an Irish dog.
Yeah.
And it's common for Irish dogs to come to England to plunder the prizes, to win the big event. But it's rare for an English dog to go to Ireland to do it. It's actually, in fairness, it's unheard of. you know, English dogs don't go to Ireland to try and plunder their prizes.
Yeah.
And we set about a plan that we wanted to go to Ireland to win the Irish Grand National. And we set that plan in motion 6-7 months prior to the event. And we did it. And it was absolutely, it was just wonderful. You know, having a long-term plan to, you know, race, take the dog to Ireland, take on the Irish on their own doorstep, and to beat them. And it was just fantastic. And in total, the dog had 44 runs for us. And in those 44 runs, he was in the first three on 36 occasions.
Yeah.
So we got lucky.
That's great. Well, let's talk a little bit about how you translated your love of greyhounds and greyhound racing into riding. Were you a hobby rider earlier in your youth, or how did you come to be a rider?
Well, when I lived in the Isle of Man, I did some freelance writing on football. You know, the local football scene, it wasn't the greatest scene in the world. You know, it's amateur football. And I used to write to the local paper, and I ended up getting a column in the paper on a Monday, which was a review of the football on the Saturday. And then on the Friday, I also had a column where I was doing a preview of the football on the Saturday. So that's where my writing skills sort of started. And then about 4 or 5 years after I moved to the back to the UK, I got a job working for a company which dealt in horse racing. And before the launch of the internet, etc., you used to have teletext on your telly. And I used to write for them. And it was horse racing reviews. I used to write on that. And that's where I got the writing bug, to be honest. But at that stage, I had no intention of writing a book. I didn't think I had the skills to write a book. And then about 3 years down the line, I bumped into John Frankham. Now, you may have heard of John Frankham. He also writes books, like very much to Dick Francis. And I was playing golf with John, and John is one of the greatest national hunt jockeys in British history. He's known as the greatest jockey. So if you've heard of Tony McCoy, he was before Tony McCoy, and you know, yeah, Everybody still refers to him as the greatest. I was playing golf with John, and I said to him, I've got this idea for a book. You know, I was in awe of John Frankham. You know, he's one of your heroes, and you're playing golf with him. You're thinking, I've got this idea for a book. So I gave him the idea for the plot, and he said, well, just go and write it. And that's all. And that was all the encouragement I needed, was, you've got an idea, just go and write it. And that was on, I think that was in about September. I started writing the book on the 1st of November, which 4 or 5 weeks later, and I finished it by the 30th of January. It took me just over 11 weeks to write the book.
That's wonderful. You know, I have a confession to make. When I first got the first Facebook message from you, and you were suggesting I read the book, I over the years, I've had any number of fellow lawyers send me their self-written, self-published books. I all thought they were going to be the next John Grisham.
Yeah.
And sadly, they were not. And I had to kindly tell them, you need to keep on writing briefs and wills and so forth, because fiction's definitely not your thing. And so I had that same, I'll confess that I had that same skepticism when I got yours. But I said, you know, what the heck? This is something I've always wanted all these years. I wanted to see a Dick Francis style novels about greyhound racing. So I jumped in, and I'm telling you, within two or three pages of it, or flicks of the Kindle screen, I was hooked. And so I just thought, when you told me that this was your first book and that you had self-published it, I thought, this is truly amazing that you were able to turn it out like that. Give me a little idea of the mechanics of how you went about writing it. For example, did you set aside a certain time each day to write? Did you write it on your computer or write it in longhand? How'd you do it?
I had one plot in the book, which the whole plot was going to be based around. And it was based on a story I'd heard many, many years ago that had never been proven. But more importantly, it had never been disproven. So nobody could do me for slander, but nobody could say that I was, you know, I was nicking the idea. it was just a story that had done the rounds of greyhound racing over the years. And I used that as my main plot. And I thought, right, but I need the characters. Now, there's some characters in there who are based on people I know, even down to their characteristics and their mannerisms. But what I did when I decided I was going to write the book, I said to these guys, I'm going to put you as a character in my book. Do you mind if I use your name? That was the first question. And I said, secondly, I'm going to be describing you to a T. And every one of them jumped in. They said, yeah, absolutely not a problem. You know? And there's one character in there. He's a great friend of mine. He won't mind me mentioning his name. His name's Phil Clark. He's one of the major characters in it. And he's old army style. He's a fellow football fan like myself. And I've described him to a T, even down to the moustache. And he gave it to his partner to read, actually only a couple of months ago, not telling her in advance who the character was based on, even though it had his name. She got halfway through the book. She said, this is you. And he said, yeah. He said, but he's described you to a T. I said, yeah. That's what I tried to do, was bring out the characteristics of the individuals. Now, there's one scene at the very, very beginning, John, you may remember, to do with a funeral in Ireland.
Yes, yes.
It's quite, and that is exactly how they work. That's how a funeral in Ireland is. Quite literally, in a small little village. You know, it's based on a funeral in Lena, and it's actually based on my own mother's funeral, believe it or not, about, you know, them all congregating and all waiting outside the church and then all going into the church. And I use that because you shouldn't, you know, find funerals amusing, shall we say. They're not the most amusing thing. But my mother's funeral was such that you could write a comedy sketch on it that, you know, any comic would be pleased of, because everything that could go wrong at a funeral went wrong. Like, for example, we had four pallbearers. Two at the front were 6'2". The one at the back was 6'2", was my brother, and me, and I'm 5'8". So you can imagine he was taking the whole weight of the coffin, and that was me. And, you know, I put my hand up to grab the handle, and the handle's come off. But that's how a village, and so I've used that. I've tried to use the personal experiences of, and describe, just elaborate on them.
Yeah,
try and bring a little humor.
I remember reading that passage at the beginning, and I was thinking, how is he going to bring this back to greyhound racing? You know, so that's the hook. It was the hook for me, just to kind of bide my time and wait to see how you reconnected it. You know, this might be a good point at which to tell our listeners a little bit, without giving away too much. Tell us about generally what the book is, the plot line of the book, which, by the way, if I didn't mention it, is Edge Your Bets is the name of the book.
Yeah. The main plot of the book is to do with a racing manager, a greyhound racing manager. And the greyhound racing manager is someone who puts together all the races and follows all the lines of integrity and makes sure you run by the rules. And he gets fitted up. Shall we say, for something he didn't do, and he's got a massive chip on his shoulder. He's felt a little bit ostracized. All the people he thought were his friends weren't his friends, and then 2 years down the line, he gets a call saying, there's something corrupt going on in the sport. I need your help. However, if anybody finds out that I've asked you for help, I'm going to completely deny it. So you're on your own. You're going to go out on your own. And the guy used his knowledge of the sport to unravel, he unearthed some skullduggery. But little did he know that the skullduggery was going to lead to him being on someone's hit list. But he didn't know why he was on their hit list. And so it goes through a story of him being beaten up. And the more he's beaten up, the more determined he becomes to actually get to the bottom of it. And little does he know that, well, the more digging he does, he uncovers who set him up and why they set him up. And without giving too much away, it then becomes a he then reverts back. So somebody from his long distant past, from his childhood, appears on the scene, who's changed his name, changed his, you know, he's been in hiding as well. And you end up having three plot lines all amalgamate together at about, I think it was about chapter 25, 26. And that's where you get to the point where you think, I know why he had the funeral. I now know why he's being fitted up. And now it's a case of how can he clear his name successfully without ending up dead in a ditch.
Yeah, that's a pretty good summary. And you know, for those who haven't read it yet and who will, there's a race fixing element. Remind me of the term for that, Kieran.
For the race fixing, it was the best way to describe it is race time manipulation.
Yeah,
one of the characters was falsifying trial times to enable somebody to make money from betting on dogs that they knew were going to win, because the trial times that had been released to the public were inaccurate. So there was one, you had one person who was fixing race times, another person was asking that person to fix the race times, and when the dogs then had their races, they had a massive advantage because they were a lot quicker than what the race trial times were given. And that was one of the things that the main character in the book, called Joe Jackson, unearthed. Everybody else was looking into it and trying to find out how were so many gambles being landed when there didn't seem to be any particular reason that they should be landed.
Yeah, yeah. I kept waiting to see how for the folks that are going to be reading the book, there's a great relationship between a young lad and a greyhound who's top class greyhound. And sometime the dog doesn't break well from the starting box, is called in the UK the traps, dwells in traps. And sometimes he's brilliant and has a brilliant break from them. And I kept thinking, how does he get this dog to do this? You reveal it in the final few pages, and it was absolutely brilliant. That's the good part, is that the time manipulation has nothing to do with doping or any harm at all to the dog. It's just about how you have some, I don't want to give it away, but it was a brilliant scheme the way they handled it. How did you, with these three plot lines running at the same time, how did you physically work it out? Did you have an outline that you began with, or did it just come out of your head as you were typing?
I had an ending. One of the first things I wrote was the ending.
Uh-huh.
So I knew what the ending was going to be, and the rest of it quite literally would be a case of, because of the job I had at the time, I was working for a betting company. I was driving to 2-3 hours every day, and I would try and do an hour before I left for work. And then other plot lines would come into me whilst I was driving. And I'd be talking into a dictaphone with ideas. And then when I got home at night, or if I was staying away at a hotel due to work, I would write some. And the character, the young lad that you referred to, and the dog relationship, that's actually based on a dog that I had, which was given to me as a 6-week-old puppy. And we were told it would never run because its mother at birth had bitten its stopper pad off. So it was never, ever going to, you know, it was never going to be a racer. And I did an awful lot of road walking with him as a pet at about a year old, up until about a year old. And we let him up in the field with the retired dog we had at home. And she was pretty quick. And we let him off up the field, and he destroyed her. I mean, he didn't know what he was doing for the first, you know, 20 yards, and she'd gone. And then he suddenly took off and went, and I suddenly thought, oh, my God, what have I got here? Took him home. He had no pain in his feet at all. There was nothing wrong with his feet. And I decided, oh, we're going to put him into training. Why don't we just try and put him into training? But all that bit about where you, the characteristics of the dog, about where there's a bit where he sits down and he gives you a paw and he rolls over and does his belly, we actually taught that dog how to do that. So we actually had a racer that actually, I remember he was racing one night and the girl who was walking could never control him because he was just a playful thing. And she's on parade and I shouted out from behind the barrier, "Archie, sit." And they're on parade and he just stopped. Back down. I said, "Archie, paw." And he stood there and he's giving her a paw. and that is something, you know, they say you can't teach an old dog new tricks, for example. Well, he just thought it was the norm. You know, that he's on parade, you know, this big race is coming up and he's just stopped, sat down, giving the girl a paw. So I could have used that as a way of in the book. We're not going to give away the plot about how the young lad, but that's the relationship the young lad has with the dog, in that the fact that the dog loves him, he loves the dog, he wouldn't do anything to harm the dog, and that's as you pointed out, there is nothing in the book which is wrong in greyhound racing. You know, it's a case of whatever. Skull dog really goes on the book. There's no cheat, there's no drugs induced or anything like that. It's just purely fiction.
Yeah. I'm a real sucker for a boy and his dog stories. And so once I hit that part of the book, I was completely hooked. So, you know, I really enjoyed that part of it that runs, you know, through the book and his relationship with the dog. And his grandfather and so forth, and who was the breeder in Ireland. And so that if you like good boy and his dog stories, this has it. This is one of the plot lines. And so I really enjoyed that aspect. But I'll have to say I enjoyed just as much trying to figure out where you were going and how they were going to I don't know much about gambling schemes and so forth. And so I was trying to figure out through each page, you know, how are they doing this? What's going to be the upshot of all this? So that I really enjoyed that part. You definitely hold the reader. I'll give you that.
Yeah, but I think, you know, we had it was around about Christmas. It was between Christmas and New Year. We had some very, very bleak, you know, you were talking about how much writing I would do. I was aiming to do probably 2,000 words a day. Now, I when I've got an idea in my head, I would write it very quickly. It would completely be grammatically incorrect because, you know, you're writing what you're thinking, and you're writing it and speak it. And I was due to be working, I was down in the southwest of England, in Exeter, and I was due to be working the following day and on New Year's Day as well. And I was staying in a hotel and the horse racing got cancelled, but I couldn't come back because I was due to be working the following day as well. And on that New Year's Eve, I wrote 15,000 words. I started writing at 9 o'clock in the morning and I finished writing at 9 o'clock that night. And I completely broke the back of the book. And quite literally, I think I wrote about 6.5 chapters, maybe 7 chapters. And it completely changed the whole context of what I was trying to do.
Yeah.
And that's where I think at that point, I actually only had 2 plot lines. And I brought in the third one. And then I have to go, once I brought the third one in, I then have to backtrack and stick in a couple of chapters earlier on in the book so that they would come in. So there's one particular character in there where there's nothing for about 4 or 5 chapters. And then he's back. And you're thinking, oh, I forgot about him. But now I know why he's back. But I have used the beauty of the book, John, I think, is the fact that the people over in the UK who have read it, when they come up to me and they say, "Was that based on me?" or "Was that based on him?" So they can see where I'm coming from, but you can't be too close to the knuckle because you run the risk of a libel suit of some sort, especially if you're not being very nice about them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's a few in there who
wasn't like it. Well, what do you attribute this? I mean, you've obviously got a creative mind to be able to, you know, especially the day you talked about where you put so many thousand words on the page. Where do you think that came from? Are you an avid reader?
Yes, in that I'm not an avid reader, as in I would read every day, but I've read, I think I've got to a stage where I've read every Dick Francis book, and I've read every John Franken book, and Jenny Pittman book, every book known to on horse racing. I'd read them all. And I think I picked up, I just finished reading, because Felix Francis took over from Dick Francis when Dick Francis died. I'm not going to say I'm in the same league as him.
Yeah, but his son. One
book. Yeah, yes, exactly. And I read one of his books, and I thought, I've got a better plot line than that. I can do better than that. I read this particular Felix Francis book, and I said to my wife, after three chapters, I said, I know who's done it. And it was, she gave me the sort of dig in the ribs of, you know what they say, well, if you think you can do any better, go and do it. And that's, that and the John Franken conversation was enough for me to turn around and say, right, I'm going to do this. And when I sat down, all I had was, I had the initial plot in my head of where I wanted it. I wrote the ending, because I thought the ending was quite clever, because I think the beauty of his, Mike Catamol is a very famous journalist over here, and in that horse racing journalist. And I was lucky enough that he wrote one of the forewords on the book for me. And he collared me after he'd read the book. He said, I don't like you anymore. I cried. And it wasn't cried because it was a sad ending. It was cried because he hadn't expected it. And I think that's the best compliment I've had from the book, is the people who've said, I've got to a certain point and I couldn't put it down. And I think that was, if you get to a certain point and people say, I couldn't put it down, then you've got them hooked.
Yeah, absolutely. I certainly got there. I read late into the night several times because I just couldn't stop, and I
wanted, yeah.
I knew I wasn't going to get to the end that night, but I wanted to make some progress so I could keep guessing how you were going to wrap things up.
Yeah, well, I used to surprise myself because I used to, I've got to finish now. It's 10 o'clock at night. I've got to finish. I'm writing away. But by leaving it hanging there, I then had something to think of when I was asleep, and B, going to work the following day, and where I wanted to take it to get to the final ending. And I was surprised how long it took me to get there, to be brutally honest, because at one point I thought, I'm only going to get up about 40,000 words in this book, so it's not going to be very long, so it's not going to do very well. And then it ended up being, I think it was the whole book itself is 109,000 words, which is an awful lot of words for a first book.
Yeah. Did you ever wake up in the middle of the night and you couldn't go back to sleep because you had this, the next plot turn, and you just had to get it down on the computer?
There was a few occasions, John, where I woke up during the middle of the night and realized that the timeline didn't fit. As in, I had something in the timeline where there was a crossover. So if anybody who was really, really on the ball, if I hadn't checked it, would have realized that something had happened the week before I said it had. So I had a whiteboard in the living room with a timeline of, set October, November, December, and making sure that there was no crossovers on the plot line. So there wasn't one particular occasion where what I was writing was a month out of date, and I needed to move it back a chapter because I'm writing it, and I suddenly realized, actually, I can't write that there. It needs to be further back. And it was really quite complicated. The timeline itself was making sure that you didn't have crossovers, because somebody would have picked up on it.
Somebody
would have picked up on the timeline. But fortunately, I got all the time. I had to work back the actual. I had to work back from the December date in the book and go backwards, and that's when I had to change all make sure all the dates tied in with the early part of the book.
Did you use any writer's tools like the Scrivener programs, or was it all just the whiteboard in your home?
It was whiteboard on the home, and all I'd used was Microsoft Word. They were the only two tools I had. It was Microsoft Word, writing away on a dilapidated laptop, and the whiteboard.
Oh, that's amazing. So you've got the book finished, and what next? I mean, did you then circulate it to friends, or what did you do next? Had you even thought, you know, am I going to publish this thing? Am I going to submit it to several publishers to see if I can get any interest? What was your plan?
My initial plan was I was just writing a book. I had no inclination of getting it published or anything like that. And I sent it to a couple of friends, and I said, "Can you have a read? Would you mind reading this?" And I knew they were avid readers, and they were people who were critical. So I knew that if it was no good, they would come back to me and say, like you would to your legal friends, stick to writing briefs. And they all came back and said, oh, "Wow, didn't know you had that in you." Type, you know. Where did that come from? I wasn't expecting that. And then I had John Franklin's number. And, you know, I picked up the phone. I actually picked up the phone to him. I said, "Hi, John, it's Kieran. You know, we played golf 6 months ago. That book you told me to write, told me to go on and write." I said, "Well, I've written it." He went, "What, already?" I said, "Yeah, I've written it, John." And the beautiful was he'd remembered me. And I said, "I don't know what to do next." So he put me in touch with his publisher, a gentleman who, and he said, "Look, speak to him, speak to this guy." So I spoke to the guy briefly on the phone, and he said, "Well, come and have a chat. We'll have a chat." So I went across London. I met him in a cafe, and we had lunch, and I told him my idea of the book. He said, "Send me a copy of the book, and I will give you an honest assessment within a week." And I sent it to him, and he came back 4 days later. He said, "You sure you haven't written any stuff before?" "No," he said, "it's very difficult to write as many characters as you've written in the third party, as in you actually think that they're the main character in the book, but they're not the main character in the book, but you've actually made them seem like they're the main character in the book." He said, that's a skill. I said, I've done that then. I've just written it as I've seen it. I said, there's no reason for doing it. I've just written as I thought it should be written. And he said, "Look, you've got a book here." But he charged me for his consultation, which you'd expect. And he sent it off to three publishers on my behalf. And all three publishers came back to me and said, "Really, really love it. Can't market it."
Really? Because of the tie-in to greyhound racing?
Right. He said, "Yeah, it's at that time. It's a sport that is, it's obviously because it's a minority sport, apart from for the people who are in the sport and who love the sport. You know, we love the sport, but it's a minority sport." And he said, "Brilliant book. It needs work. Obviously, it needs to be proofread, and it needs to be edited." He said, "Because it's obviously written by somebody who's, you know, who's not from a publishing background, which I'm not. You know, I'm just Joe Bloggs who wrote a book." And he said, "But if you can get it, see if you can circulate it around." So I wrote to the Racing Post, who are the biggest racing publication covering horse racing and greyhound racing in the UK. Yeah. And I sent it to the guy, the main book editor there. And I thought, well, I'll not hear back from him. And he came back to me within a week. He said, "Oh, I love this. Or can you leave it with me? We got a meeting in a couple of weeks." So I left it with him for a couple of weeks. And a month passed, and he still hadn't come back to me. And I rang him up. I said, "Well, what do you think?" He said, "I love it." He said, "But we don't publish fiction. We only do autobiographies." So every book that they pay for to be published and marketed through the Racing Post is a factual book.
Yeah.
So we don't do fiction. So I got to this stage now where people were saying to me, "You need to get this published." And I just went online and I looked for somebody for self-publishing. I found this guy called Frank. Frank's Formatting, I think his name was at the time. Sent it off to him, and he did all the work. And he got me my ISBN numbers. He made sure that I did all the tax implications for self-publication, et cetera, et cetera. And we sorted out the front cover of the book, which is a fantastic, for those of you who look at it online, it's a beautiful, it's a greyhound running on a beach in northwest of Scotland.
I was going to ask you where the cover came from.
It's an action photo of somebody's pet dog. And we were on Facebook, and we sent out, anybody got any greyhound pictures that we could use? So this is quite literally how we did it. Anybody got any greyhound pictures that they wouldn't mind me using on the front cover of my book? And we came back with about 50 to 60 photos were sent through to us. And that one jumped out to me straight away because it looked like it was in Ireland and it was on a beach. And I thought that ties in well with the background. And it's just a greyhound running free and enjoying himself.
Do you see that dog as being Archie? Of course, Archie was black, as I recall, wasn't he?
Yeah, no. Archie was fawn. Archie was. Archie was a fawn dog. No, I just thought it was a beautiful picture of a dog in full stride with the shadow in the sand and, you know, his feet, all 4 feet off the ground. A greyhound doing what it loves doing best, and that's just running and stretching out. And the actual title of the book itself is, you know, a lot of people say to me, oh, where'd you get the title of the book? Is it linked in to, you know, the plot line? Edge Your Bets is actually the name of the first greyhound I ever bought.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I had first dog I bought was a puppy. So Pole Rating was one that I obviously bought off the trainer. And when Pole Rating, his career finished, this was one I bought out on my own. I bought it as a puppy, and we named her, and she was out of, her mother's name was Annie Edge, and there was something else to do with betting, and I thought Edge of Bets, as in because, you know, the Irish don't pronounce the H's, you know, this, that, and the other, you know, and I've got lots of trees, but I've got three trees, and got no, so I thought if you take the H out of Edge, you've got Edge of Bets. I just thought it was a nice catchy name. And that's where the name of the book comes from. But it ties in really well with the story of the books. Because the main character is constantly, if you like, hedging his bets. Do I take that risk or not take the risk?
So on the self-publishing aspect of it, if you don't mind revealing, about what does it cost to self-publish a book of this type?
At the time when I published it in 2014, I think all in, it cost me about £1,100.
That's not bad. Is that printing? And I mean, did you do an initial run of so many copies of the book, or how did that work?
Yeah. I did an initial run of 200 copies of the book, which obviously the more copies you do, the cheaper it becomes. I think it worked out the total cost per book for getting it printed was about £5.49 per book. Well, that's purely on the number of pages in the book, because obviously the thicker it is, the more pages they were used. If I'd been about 20 pages shorter, the price of the book would have come down by about £1 per book. But, you know, I didn't make a loss on it, John. At the end of the day, I gave the majority of the money I made on the book to charity. I made a promise to the homing charity at Wimbledon Greyhound Stadium that for every book I sell, I will give you 40% of the profits.
Oh, that's marvelous.
We did a book signing down at the sanctuary for where the greyhounds were. It's a greyhound retirement kennels. It's a homing kennels. And my wife worked there at the time. And we had a book signing there. And I sold so many books, I just said, hey, you can have all the money.
Oh, that's marvelous.
I didn't write the book to make money. The amount of books, it's sold now through Amazon. Every time I sell a book, I get £2.51. I feel like a pop star when I see a payment comes through on my bank statement. Say, oh, by the way, you sold three books this month. That's handy. I think between Amazon and the ones I sold in person, I think we sold just under 1,000 books.
Oh, that's marvelous.
I wrote it for my own benefit rather than anything else.
Yeah.
It was like I made a little bit of money. I didn't lose money on it.
Yeah.
I think that's the best way to describe it. I didn't lose any money on it. I put it on Kindle. It's on Kindle for free, I think. And if people want to read it on Kindle, you know, I think, you know, people ask me, what was the biggest achievement? What was the nicest thing you had from writing the book? And this is a true story. I was on the tube one day going to a meeting in London, and there was a young girl sat opposite me reading my book.
That had to be a good feeling.
It was a fantastic feeling. I'm just glad she didn't look on the back cover to see that there was some weirdo looking across at her. She paid £10.90. You know, the best feeling is the fact that somebody's bought your book, and the worst feeling is if you ever go to a flea market and see it for sale for 5p.
Was it expensive to get it put on Kindle? I read it on Kindle.
No, it wasn't expensive. That was all part of the deal when I got published.
Yeah.
When we set it up on Amazon, it was all part of the same deal. And I think it's still there. It's still there on Kindle. And no, it was all included in the price of setting it up. So, you know, the fact that people enjoyed it, but that for me was nice to see.
Yeah,
somebody.
Absolutely.
And, you know, so people have said to me, why didn't you go over and introduce yourself? I said, no, I look like a right weirdo going over to say, oh, by the way, do you know you're reading my book? That would put her off for the rest of her life. But the pressure I've had now since is I've started writing I started another book in 2016, and I have to scrap that one for legal reasons because what I was actually writing actually happened.
Ah.
And so it can no longer fiction, it was fact.
Yeah.
So I then started another one in 2017, and I didn't like it. And the third one I started about a year ago. I got 45,000 words into the book, and a legal case. One of the people I was going to use as a character in the book got done for something that wasn't great on the integrity of the book. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to scrap that and take that whole character out of the book. So I'm at a place now where I'm two-thirds through the next book, and this one, John, I honestly believe is far better than the first one.
Really?
I honestly do believe, because
that's marvelous.
Nobody has a clue who has done the... again, I've tried to do it in the same similar format with three stories that will amalgamate into one, but I don't even know the ending.
Do you carry over any characters from Edge Your Bets?
Yeah, there are a couple. There's the young lad is back in it. The young lad is back in it. There is the Phil Cart character, who's, you know, part of the regulatory body. He's back in it. The main character from the first book has a passing in it. He's mentioned in dispatches, as they say. But the granddad in Ireland and the young lad, they come back in at a later date into the book, and they have a big say in what goes on in the main plot. But you won't actually see them until about halfway through the book.
Oh, excellent. Do you think you'll have that one done?
Well, now that we've gone back into lockdown over here, probably by the end of next month.
Oh, excellent.
So I won't have... Well, if the lockdown comes down as seriously as, you know, we're expecting it to, then we're all going to be going nowhere, aren't we? So I'm going to be sat at home and writing away, and see if I can borrow a girlfriend's computer to write it on, because my laptop has seen better days. I think what's the word? No longer fit for purpose.
Yes,
It takes longer to turn on than it does takes to boil a kettle. I think I know. I know it's gone. But no, the next plot of the book is actually the next book is quite clever in that, again, to try and keep the readers involved, it's again a crossover between horse racing and dog racing. Well, the main story is obviously going to be dog racing.
Oh, that's excellent.
It's based around a character who was a champion jockey who has a really, really nasty fall. He takes up a completely new career. He becomes a film director, and he's doing his filming using drones and stuff like that, you know, high up in the sky. And unbeknown to him, whilst he's doing his filming, he catches something on camera that wasn't supposed to be caught on camera. He becomes the target of people trying to get hold of the film, and he has no idea who's trying to get hold of the film, why they want to get hold of the film, but he's an avid greyhound fan. His one vice in life from being a champion jockey is he loves greyhounds. And he buys a dog that ends up being favourite for the English Derby. There's a plot line in there where he gets kidnapped. The dog, that is, gets kidnapped. So they have to scrap that target. So then the next target is to go to Ireland to take the, as we were saying right at the very beginning, an English dog going to Ireland to take them on their own soil. So I think from personal experience about how that feels and how he can, you know, I can express that across about the euphoria of and the excitement of going on, taking on, if you like, the Irish are 80% of greyhounds that run in England are born in Ireland.
So
to go back to Ireland, take them on.
Do you have a title yet?
I do have a title, actually, yeah. It's called Stump.
Stump, S-T-U-M-P?
S-T-U-M-P-E-D.
Okay. Well, that sounds great. We'll look forward to that. And when you are you going to self-publish, or do you think you're going to get a few publishers interested?
No, I'll self-publish. What I found very disappointing about the book over here, John, is strange. The reviews of the people who've read it on Amazon are people who've mainly read the Dick Francis genre books. And, you know, they've come back and wow, really enjoyed it, really excited. But the number of people in the UK within the greyhound industry who bought it over here was very few. It didn't sell. It wouldn't sell over here. I had interest from Australia. A friend of mine was trying to market it in Australia for me, and he took it to the publishers in Australia around about the same time as they were trying to ban greyhound racing in Australia. So it probably wasn't the best time to take the book to them. But he is saying that if I get the second one done, then he will go all out to try and get the Australian publishers to take the book, because they love their greyhound racing in Australia.
Great. Yeah, an author's dream is to have their book made into a movie. Have you been approached by anybody, any movie makers, to have it? I can see all the characters in my head every time I read it, and an opportunity it'd be to promote the greyhound and greyhound racing.
When I wrote the book and then I read it back myself for the first time about 6 months ago during lockdown, and the first thing that came to my mind was it would make a great movie, and I've even got it in my head, the actors who could play certain characters. Like you look at the grandfather one in the book, something like Brendan Gleeson.
Yes,
Character. He would carry him off to an absolute T. He's got his Irish roots. He's got his Irish accent. You know, he'd be brilliant in it. But, you know, there are so many characters who you would... I think it'd make a great... I'm going to say that because I wrote the book. But if somebody ever wanted to approach me, I'd probably bite their hand off. But it's just, how do you get somebody within that industry to read a book like that? Because it's different. It's just, it's different in that it's not been done before.
Yes.
You know, the films that have been done mainly about greyhound racing have been comical, as in, you know, the greyhound is the butt of the jokes, or the fact that it's a dog that won't. The normal genre is it's got a greyhound, doesn't run very fast, it will stop, and, you know, everybody loses their money. Whereas this is really, it's a greyhound, but it's a story about, it's the greyhound is the peripheral of the story.
Yeah.
It's unearthing the skullduggery that goes on in greyhound racing on a day-to-day basis. And unfortunately, it does. So, you know, the stuff that I've highlighted in that book is, it goes on. Unfortunately, having worked in racing offices, I've seen it. And it's quite scary. So I'm writing from personal experience some of the stuff I've seen done.
Yeah. Now, Karen, I'd be remiss if we didn't mention, I think I've seen on your Facebook page, you've got a greyhound pet or two. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is true. Yes, John. We've got a retired greyhound who called Lola, who is just gone 3 years old. I bought it for my girlfriend as a pet. She'd never had a greyhound in her life. I bought it for her at 3 months old. We went to Ireland. It was bought for her. So I let her choose it. Slow as a boat, John. No word of a lie.
It did have a shot at racing, but it was just too slow.
No, it had a problem that it wouldn't turn left at the first bend.
Oh.
In that it'd fly out of the boxes. It would go into the first bend three lengths clear and come out of it four lengths behind because it just wouldn't turn left. Really brilliant in a straight line, but she's absolutely, absolutely adorable. You know, we took a decision very early in her career that it wasn't a case of she wasn't enjoying it. It's just a case of she just wasn't very good.
We
took the decision to retire. I think it was just before her second birthday we retired her. And we brought her home, and it's the best thing I've ever done. She just loves to run. She's got absolutely no recall in that if you let her off, you're letting her off in your brave, because you may not see her again. But we're lucky where we live that, as you saw on the videos, we've got access to horse race gallops because I'm in Lambourne, which is the national hunt horse racing centre of the UK, is where I live. And there's lots of horse paddocks and stuff like that, and where that video was taken was between paddocks. And it's enclosed at both ends. So we just let her off. And she'll run up and down for about 20 minutes. And once she stops, she'll stop. And she's absolutely loves to run. But I swear she is either as deaf as a post or just completely ignores me. The only time she actually acknowledges my voice is when it's dinner time. Lola, dinner. Oh, right, I'll get up now. I would recommend a greyhound pet to absolutely anybody. They are the best animal you ever.
Absolutely. Well, Karen, it's been a pleasure. We're running out of time, and I just want to reiterate to everybody, all our listeners, this is an excellent book. If you've got any interest in greyhounds, greyhound racing, the relationship between trainers and their greyhounds, et cetera, it's Edge Your Bets. It's available on Kindle in both the U.S. and the U.K. and Ireland. And I can't say enough about what a good read it is.
Thank you, John.
So thanks for being with us. And get that other book finished, and let's get that thing out on Amazon so I can start reading that one.
I'll do you a deal, John. As soon as I finish doing it, I will send you over the unedited proof for you to have a read.
Oh, excellent. All right. Well, thanks very much, Kieran. And you're doing a great thing for greyhounds by adding to the literature of greyhound racing.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. You can subscribe to Greyhound Nation wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please be sure to leave a review. You can also write to us via the contact form on our website, greyhoundnation.dog. That's greyhoundnation.dog. We're also on Facebook. Search for our Grey Nation Show page. You can also tweet at us. It's @GreyNationShow on Twitter. And if you're on Instagram, we're there too. Just follow @GreyNationShow. This episode was produced in collaboration with host John Parker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dimitri Taras. We'd also like to thank this episode's guest, Kieran O'Brien, author of Edge Your Bets. Kieran's book is available for purchase on Amazon Kindle or in paperback. I'm Michael Burns, and you've been listening to Greyhound Nation.